From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Thursday, Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot out of the sky above eastern Ukraine. Almost 300 people were killed. The White House and its allies say it was a surface-to-air missile originating from pro-Russian separatists backed by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Today, as international investigators still struggle to gain complete access to the crash site and recovered bodies, the U.S. and its allies condemn Russia. This hour on Point, the international crisis around the shooting down of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. Later this hour, we'll talk to a reporter in Gaza on the recent deadly violence there. But first, joining me now from Washington is Julie Pace, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Julie, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Julie, catch us up to date on where the White House thinks it stands after the weekend. We had escalating criticism from John Kerry and others of Russia. Do they believe that they're making diplomatic process and process with the investigation?
At this point, what you're seeing from the U.S. is a real outlining of the case. Not a lot of hard evidence at this point, but a lot of assertions. They are really trying to make the case that this missile that took down this plane not only came from the areas of eastern Ukraine where these pro-Russian separatists are, but were actually fired by those separatists with help from Russia. And one of the questions right now that they're really trying to focus on is how much Russian involvement was there. Is this simply Russia providing the weaponry and the training, or were there actually Russian personnel who may have been involved in the actual shooting? Was this an order that came from the Russian government? Those are the questions I think you're going to see the White House looking to answer over the next day or two.
Julie, am I right to think of those questions as principally a function of intelligence? Because there's a lot of discussion about the integrity of the crash site. Those things don't really have anything to do with the crash site, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the crash site itself, they're still trying to get evidence from there, but we know that the evidence has been tampered with, that there have been things that have been removed from the site, and we don't exactly know what those things are. So that makes that more complicated. So this really is an intelligence matter at this point. And they do have some intelligence that Russian personnel moved some of this equipment into the pro-separatist-controlled areas over the past couple of weeks. So they believe that they can make that link strongly. The question is, how strongly will they be able to connect Russia, the Russian government, to the actual action that took place last week?
Well, while they sift through the intelligence evidence that they have, what is the relevance of the actual investigation of the crash site, and what's the U.S. role in that?
So the U.S. role at this point is actually fairly small. There's been one person sent over from the FBI, one person sent over from the NTSB, and they are trying to join an international investigation. Part of the reason that we keep hearing this focus on an international investigation is to try to confer some legitimacy on this. If this is simply a U.S.-run process, then the Russians are just going to say, well, this is a U.S.-Ukrainian conspiracy. We've already started to hear some of that. So you are going to see the U.S. trying to join other countries, but there's a lot of problems with accessing the crash site. You know, this is basically in the middle of a war zone, so this is not like going to a crash site that's in the middle of a field, an open area. This is a war zone, and these rebels, these separatists, don't want to let people get in there.
The ultimate question is whether or not this changes the course of the conflict in Ukraine and forces Vladimir Putin to back off. The United States has been imposing gradually increasing sanctions, although not of the most severe variety, and Europe is reluctant to do even as much as the United States has done. What is the White House thinking on whether or not that equation is changing and that we are, in fact, and the West is so shocked by this event that it's going to ratchet up in a dramatic way the level of sanctions?
Well, there's some theory that this may end up working in the White House's favor in terms of European sanctions. The president announced some sanctions last week that were far tougher than what he has done up until this point. They actually started to go after some sectors of the Russian economy. The Europeans have not been willing to go that far. There is going to be a meeting of EU officials this week in Brussels, and the White House is pushing the Europeans to try to at least match where the U.S. is at this point. The bigger question, though, is, you know, do those sanctions have any effect on Vladimir Putin's calculus? So far, the individual business sanctions that the U.S. and Europe have done have not had an impact on his calculus. So are sanctions even the right approach? That's the larger question at this point.
Well, so there is some skepticism that even broad sectoral sanctions might not affect Russia's thinking?
I think the point is that the sanctions may have an impact on the economy of Russia, but does that impact the way that Putin thinks about his actions? There's a lot of popularity for the Russian actions, for Russian separatists within Russia. So Putin has not seen his own popularity harmed by what's happening in Ukraine.
I noticed the New Yorker has a profile of Joe Biden out this morning that quotes Joe Biden as saying that he got very close to Putin's face at one point in a meeting and said, "You have no soul," which is vivid counterpoint to the exchange that George W. Bush had with the press when he said, I looked into his soul. What sort of tough talk, in addition to that, do you think we're going to be hearing? And how does the White House feel about what Biden said?
Well, there's plenty of tough talk. I don't think there's a shortage of that. You know, there's this debate, though, over how you deal with Putin. So far, the White House's approach has been to keep an open line of communication with Putin. They feel like it's better to be talking to him and being able to try to read the signals that they're getting from those conversations than to cut him off. That's something that critics would like the White House to do, but it's just not this White House's style, and they feel like it's also ineffective. I think in terms of how the White House might view Biden's comments, you know, there are cases where people other than the president, like the vice president, like other top officials, can say things that maybe the president can't get away with. And I certainly don't think they would argue with what the vice president said.
Do you have a sense, Julie, as to how the White House is coping with the breadth of international problems they're dealing with? I mean, when you think of it, the same people, Susan Rice, John Kerry, others on the national security team, they're dealing with Syria, they're dealing with Gaza, they're dealing with this situation in the Ukraine. Does that have an effect on the U.S. response?
I don't know if it has an effect on the U.S. response necessarily, but it certainly has an effect with just the sheer amount of active crises that this White House is dealing with. Obviously, the White House, the State Department, is always dealing with situations all over the world, but it is rare to have so many hotspots, so many active crises that are going on. And, you know, there are links between some of them, not necessarily, you know, Syria and Russia, but obviously the situation in Syria has impacted the situation in Iraq and broader instability in the Middle East. And you have a lot of the same people who are involved in managing all of these crises. One thing that I would say that I hear a lot from people at the White House, though, is they try, and this is a message that comes straight from, you know, Dennis McDonough, the president's chief of staff, they are always trying to tell their team to not think about the idea that they are living in an extraordinary time, that this is harder or more difficult than what other presidents have faced. They feel like if you start thinking that way, then that can lead to overreach. That can lead to presidents doing things outside the systems of checks and balances.
So they reject the argument that this is the most turbulent or chaotic period the world's faced in decades.
Right. They would say that the world is always turbulent, that there are always crises, and that whatever you're in, the moment that you're in right now, always feels worse than what you remember it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And they really try to avoid giving off the impression internally in particular that they are in an extraordinary time, because then again, they feel like that leads to overreach.
Do you sense, Julie, any sensitivity on the part of the White House to this charge that is leveled by some critics, some in the press, that the president shouldn't be conducting his normal schedule, shouldn't be meeting with ordinary voters over a burger in Delaware or wherever he's traveling while this sort of thing is going on, that he ought to get back in the White House and be seen conducting crisis management?
They are perhaps as sensitive to that charge as anything else. This is a White House that has tried to avoid, purposely tried to avoid giving in to those calls, not just over the past week or so, but just throughout his presidency. They insist that the president can do his job from wherever he is. And to some extent, that is true. He can make calls to foreign leaders. He can be briefed on intelligence matters from wherever he is. The tricky part of this, though, is that while optics may not be the most important thing that's going on right now, it is what the public, to a large extent, sees. You know, where do they see the president? Where is the video coming from? Where are the photos coming from? What's the backdrop where he's speaking? And there is this odd split screen that happens where you have crises happening all over the world and the president out on a burger run or raising money. He's going to be this week fundraising for 3 days on the West Coast.
Well, do you see them changing, as much as they've tried to resist it, do you see them changing that calculus now?
I don't think you're going to see him change this trip. I think he still plans to depart and go to California and Seattle. What I think you will see, though, is the White House trying to incorporate some remarks from the president during that trip where he will mention the situation. Or we'll be getting a lot of foreign call readouts. We'll be getting a lot of notes about briefings that the president has had.
Julie Pace, White House correspondent for the Associated Press, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're discussing the Malaysia Airlines flight shot down over eastern Ukraine. Later this hour, we'll talk to a reporter in Gaza on the recent deadly violence there. But first, more on the Malaysia Airlines plane shot down. Now joining us from Washington is Stephen Pfeiffer, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He now directs Brookings Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative and a senior fellow at the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. Stephen Pfeiffer, welcome back to On Point.
Happy to be here.
Also from Washington, Angela Stent joins us. She's director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and the author, most recently, of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Angela, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be on the show, John.
Let's start by listening to sound this morning from Russian President Vladimir Putin. In a statement to Russian TV, Putin said, "It is necessary to ensure international experts have access to the crash site of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. Here it is interpreted by BBC News.
A fully-fledged expert group to work there. It is necessary to do everything to ensure its full absolute security and provide the humanitarian corridors it needs in its work."
And now let's hear from President Obama at his press conference on Friday when he was asked if Russia and Vladimir Putin bear the ultimate responsibility for the shootdown.
The violence that's taking place there is facilitated in large part, because of Russian support. And they have the ability to move those separatists in a different direction.
Stephen Pfeiffer, let me start with you. Do you hear any cracks in Putin's statement that indicate a different calculus that he might make about Ukraine?
Not so far. I believe that Mr. Putin is sitting in Moscow carefully watching and trying to calculate what is going to be the blowback from the West on this. Certainly he made the call for free international access for the investigators to the crash site, but you didn't see anything happening over the weekend. It's only today that it looks like the experts, the Dutch forensic experts, are getting some access. And the Russians could have been using their influence on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to make this happen.
Well, so do you believe then that for all the talk about this being a shock the conscience game changer in this situation, that maybe it's not going to be that?
Well, I think there is still that possibility. The overwhelming evidence points to the fact that the Malaysian airliner was brought down by a surface-to-air missile fired by Ukrainian separatists, probably an accident. But the question is, who gave them that missile? And again, most evidence suggests the Russians gave them that missile. Now, this could be a game changer, and the one good thing that might come out of this tragedy, if this could in fact shock the system. And my guess is for Mr. Putin to make the change in course, he's going to have to look to the West and see that there is going to be huge pressure on him, probably in the form of additional sanctions, if he's going to consider adjusting his policy course.
Angela, what do you see in what you've heard from Vladimir Putin and what you've heard from Europe on the potential for a genuine step up in a very meaningful way of economic sanctions?
Well, I think we have to understand. I mean, first of all, I would agree with Steve Pieper that it would be good if this could be a game changer. But you have to understand the context here. First of all, we talk about separatists. These are insurgents, and the leaders of these separatist groups are, in fact, Russian citizens, and they've come from Russia. So there are very, very close connections with Russia. The reason why there is this insurgency is that the Russian policy has been to destabilize Ukraine as much as possible and make it very difficult, if not impossible, for President Poroshenko and his government to function in a meaningful way. And we see that. They can't guarantee international observers access to the site. Now, I'm not sure whether anything that's happened in the last few days with this tragedy has changed Putin's mind on this, has changed the balance for him. I'm also rather skeptical about whether there will be tougher sanctions from the Europeans. Yes, we heard that they're meeting tomorrow. They're discussing more sanctions. But Chancellor Merkel again has said today, we have to both talk to the Russians, and of course she's talking to President Putin, I think practically every day, and then we have to consider other sanctions. The Europeans are being very cautious because, you know, they have a great economic stake in the relationship with Russia, and they're going to be very reluctant to impose more sanctions. Prime Minister David Cameron yesterday had an article in the London Sunday Times where he was very tough on Russia and said that there should be more sanctions. But I doubt that the French, that are in the middle of selling these amphibious ships to the Russians, the Mistral or the Germans or the Italians, for instance, will want to impose more sanctions. So I think if I were Putin, I would be waiting this out. I would be seeing, you know, how angry the Europeans are going to get, what the consequences might be. And then the final point I'll make, and it was already made by a reporter in the beginning, is that even though the sanctions up to date have had an economic impact on Russia, the economy there is definitely sliding downwards, they don't seem to have had the kind of political impact that we, the United States, or the Europeans would like. That is to say, we haven't seen a change in Russian actions. We've heard a number of words from Putin that are more conciliatory, but again, we have to wait and see what the Russians actually do as opposed to what they say.
Stephen, does that mean that until public opinion in Russia changes, and of course, Putin's been surfing a wave of popularity, that his own behavior is not going to change? And if that's the case, why would an event like this not affect Russian public opinion when you've got 300 people being shot out of the sky?
Well, first of all, I don't think public opinion in Russia is going to be a big factor because public opinion in Russia is being shaped by what they're seeing by the Russian media, much of which is state-controlled. And Russian media is broadcasting things like, for example, on Thursday night on one of the main Russian media news networks, they put up a picture of the Malaysian airliner and they put up a picture of Mr. Putin's Russian Air Force plane. And they said these planes look a little bit alike, and the theory then is the Ukrainians thought they were shooting down Mr. Putin's plane. Now, it begs two questions. One is that what was Mr. Putin's plane doing over Ukraine? That's probably the last place it would be. And second, they're saying, well, they look alike. You know, if you've ever looked up at an airplane 33,000 feet up from the ground, you don't see colors, you see a dot. But this is the kind of nonsense that's being broadcast. But so far, a lot of the Russian public seems to be buying it. I would very much go back to Angela's point. I think it's very important here to see how the Europeans react. If the Europeans, who are all expressing understandable outrage, though, then proceed not to adopt stiffer sanctions, the basic signal that they're going to be sending Mr. Putin is you are free to continue business as usual in eastern Ukraine, free to continue to destabilize the country, free to continue to allow the flow of arms to go into the separatists, and they're basically going to have to be prepared to see the death toll climb. It may not be Dutch or German or Malaysian or Australian citizens, but the number of dead will increase.
I have to say, and I'll put this out to both of you, I'm a little dumbfounded by the idea that Europe would not step up sanctions. Is it right to think of this as a craven clutch for the pocketbook, even though scores of Dutch citizens riding an Asian airliner were blown out of the sky in a conflict. If this doesn't internationalize it and bring others in, what could?
I'm quite surprised that even the Dutch government has been very cautious in what it said about Russia. No rush to judgment, etc. I think you have to understand that Europe isn't united on this. But in the past 22 years, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, many European countries have developed very strong economic ties to Russia. The banking system in England, you have all of these very, very wealthy Russians who own, the finest and most expensive real estate in London, and also, again, have their money in the banks there. So for each country, and for instance, Chancellor Merkel is always under a lot of pressure from her business community whenever she tries to take a tougher stance against Russia, not to pursue sanctions. And so the mantra is always dialogue, dialogue, dialogue. Now, dialogue is important, obviously. One shouldn't cut off the dialogue with Russia. But most European countries, and I'm accepting here countries like Poland or the Baltic states, obviously, but many of the European countries seem to have convinced themselves that if you keep talking to the Russians, eventually they'll change what they do. And unless in the past 8 months, since all of this crisis broke out in Ukraine, we really haven't seen that. But if you ask the question, what would it take to make them change their mind and really impose more drastic sanctions, I'm really not sure that it would take anything. And I would like to add one more thing, and that is that to some extent, in a country like Germany, the willingness to give Mr. Putin the benefit of the doubt is directly correlated to the criticism and suspicion of the United States. And in the German case, things like the Edward Snowden leaks, and then what we've heard recently about, U.S. intelligence activities in Germany, that feeds directly into this questioning, for instance, of what the U.S. has now said about what happened in this crash, and a greater willingness to maybe listen to the Russian version of this, which is, of course, outrageous.
Angela, I want to go to one of our callers. We've got Monica on the line from North Tonawanda, New York. Monica, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on. I'm not sure if it's so much a question. I wondered, and I haven't heard yet on your show anybody talking of a more extreme measure. I think that there's been a small declaration of war by shooting down airliner, and that I don't think dialogue at this time is going to make the statements that the Americans probably want to see.
Military action then, Monica?
Yes. Yeah, I think I'm not saying drop any bombs right now. I think maybe military ships out in the seas outside of Ukraine and Russia, perhaps some show of strength on our part and our allies. I understand that the monies in London stem from Russia or something like that, the woman just said. But, and I'm normally a peace-loving person, but I think that we need to show some sign of strength.
Monica, thanks for your call. Our connection's not very good. I want to go to Stephen Pfeiffer. Stephen, is military action, which the administration so far has seemed to rule out, is that even within the realm of possibility? Should it be?
Well, you have seen over the last 3 to 4 months since Russia occupied Crimea, American military action or American military deployments primarily designed to assure eastern members of NATO, the Baltic states, Poland. So there are now American airborne troops deployed in the Baltic states and Poland. You've seen much more naval activity by U.S. Navy ships in the Black Sea than you have in the previous 3 or 4 years. But again, the primary focus there is to assure allies who are now much more nervous about Russian intentions than they were, say, 6 months ago. With regards to military action against Russia, my guess is that there is no stomach in the United States or in NATO to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. And I think that's been made very clear, and I believe that's understood by the Ukrainians, which is important because you don't
want to. And you think that's an appropriate position?
I think so. I though then turn back to the economic sanctions. And again, I may be a little bit more hopeful than Angela. I do think that there is a chance that sanctions could have an impact here. I do hope that Europe does not sort of end up dismissing this and looking for reasons not to apply the sanctions because, again, there's a signal to the Russians. And I think if Mr. Putin sees that he can continue this course without significant pain in terms of the Western reaction, he will see no reason not to continue to supply weapons, to supply leadership to the separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk and eastern Ukraine. And this nasty little conflict is going to go on and on and on.
I want to hear from the Secretary of State and then one of his critics. Yesterday on ABC's This Week, Secretary of State John Kerry said Russia shares responsibility for what's happening in Ukraine.
Russia has armed the separatists. Russia has supported the separatists. Russia has trained the separatists. Russia continues to refuse to call publicly for the separatists to engage in behavior that would lend itself to a resolution of this issue.
Now, on one of the other Sunday shows, NBC's Meet the Press, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Republican, conveyed his frustration with the Obama administration's approach. He was critical of John Kerry, his former colleague's comments that the U.S. is in the center leading and trying to make peace in Gaza and Ukraine.
As Secretary Kerry, he gave the most ridiculous and delusional summary of American foreign policy I could imagine. It scares me that he believes the world is in such good shape. America is the glue that holds the free world together. Leading from behind is not working. The world is adrift, and President Obama has become the king of indecision.
Angela, is Secretary of State Kerry delusional, and are you scared too?
I wouldn't use the word delusional. I mean, we have to understand that in this situation, there's a limit to what the U.S. can do. Ukraine is the number one foreign policy priority for Mr. Putin and his Kremlin, and trying to prevent Ukraine from moving closer toward Euro-Atlantic structures. Even though we are heavily involved in Ukraine, or we became so after the events in November, this is not the number one priority for us. I mean, you already, again, the White House correspondent talked about all of the other major crises which this administration has to deal with. And therefore, we're doing as much as we can. But unilaterally, there's a limit to what we can do, again, unless our allies, our European allies, support us on this. At this point, Mr. Putin, I mean, there's already international ostracism, right? Russia's not in the G8 anymore. I don't know whether it will come back. The Australian Prime Minister has talked about not inviting Russia to the G20 meeting.
Talk of canceling the World Cup, which is scheduled to take place in Russia.
Right. I mean, one can talk about all of that, and maybe some of that will have to be done in addition to sanctions. But the point is at this juncture, it's not clear whether any of this matters to Mr. Putin, that he has gotten himself into this mindset and he has 83% popularity rate because what he's doing in Ukraine is popular, because that's all that the majority of the Russian population hears on their state-sponsored media, and that's what's important for him, position in Russia.
Stephen Pfeiffer, has the United States been too weak? And if we were not too weak, would it make a difference?
No, I think the issue here is the United States has tried to move in conjunction with Europe and has been reluctant to get into a situation where American sanctions get way out in front of the European sanctions for fear that you create an opportunity for Russia to play one side off against the other. But again, I hope and I believe there's a lot of communication going back and forth across the Atlantic now to try to work a new set of Western sanctions that might get Mr. Putin's attention and try to move from just inflicting economic pain on the Russian economy to the kind of jolt that would get Mr. Putin to change his course in Ukraine.
Steve Pfeiffer and Angela Stent, wait right there. We're discussing Malaysia Airlines flight shot down over eastern Ukraine. You can join the conversation. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the Malaysia Airlines plane shot down over eastern Ukraine. And I want to start by playing a little audio from a witness, just to keep in mind exactly what we're talking about here, of a local witness who saw the Malaysian Airlines flight go down, interpreted by Reuters.
I saw a piece of the plane fall about 400 meters from my apartment. When I went to check it out, I saw scattered bodies. From a distance, it looked like debris was falling, but as it turned out, it was people falling out of the aircraft.
people falling out of an aircraft. Angela Stent, the United States is sifting through its intelligence to try to figure out how it can pinpoint responsibility for this missile firing. What is the relevance of the proof, or do you think that we already essentially know the contours of this and the details that come out more specifically later won't make such a big effect?
Well, I think we have a pretty good idea of what happened, and that is, of course, you know, as our government officials have said, that this missile was fired from a Buk missile system. This is a Russian system. It was fired in eastern Ukraine, and probably it was mistakenly fired because these separatists had already shot down a couple of Ukrainian military aircraft that week, and that they thought that they were shooting down another Ukrainian military aircraft, and they mistook it for a commercial aircraft. That's probably what the story is, and we've known that for a couple of days. The problem is, this is disputed, obviously, by the people in the region, by the separatists. It's disputed by the Russians. Countries like China have been very careful. You know, they keep saying we need an international investigation.
Does so anyone believe the Russians and the separatists?
I mean, I'm sure that, you know, if I go on the blogosphere, maybe I shouldn't. And there are plenty of people around the world who probably do believe the Russians and the separatists. I'm not sure how many, you know, and I don't know what the U.S. would have to do, how much proof it would have to give to have most of the world accept this. But you do have to have an international inquiry, particularly because Russia is disputing it, or Russia and the Ukrainian government have such a different view. And that's why you have to have it. But I don't know how conclusive that will be, because we have to assume that Russia and its separatist partners will do everything to make sure that the truth does not come out.
Stephen, yes, go ahead, please.
I'd add a couple of points. No, I think in terms of an international investigation, the Ukrainians today have asked the Dutch to take the lead, given that the largest number of fatalities on the flight were Dutch. And I think some combination of the Dutch and perhaps the Malaysians, and then you bring in the international civil aviation authorities. But I think second Angela's point. I think we probably already know as much as we need to know. When the experts get the access to the crash site and the data boxes, the black boxes will likely show the plane flying a normal flight until something catastrophic occurred. And I think access to the crash site, we'll see, and there's already been a picture out this morning that somebody posted showing a part of the aircraft riddled with the kind of shrapnel that would be produced by a surface-to-air missile. So the access to the crash site will confirm what I think virtually everybody agrees is a surface-to-air missile brought the airliner down. But it's not going to give you conclusive proof, even if you find the missile fragments, that who exactly fired the missile.
Stephen, do you think that the grotesque accounts of the crash site itself, with separatists blocking and interfering with access, with bodies sitting in refrigerated train cars in a fly-infested train station, will any of that itself drive the international reaction?
Well, that's going to continue to contribute to the sense of outrage. I mean, the separatists originally said they would allow access when the first team of OSCE monitors arrived on Friday, Saturday. They were restrained. They could not have full access. So, in a way, the separatists have handled this almost as if they're trying to hide something. And again, I think most of the evidence points back to them, including a posting by one of the separatist leaders, Igor Strelkov, who bragged on social media.
It's pretty obvious they are trying to hide something, right?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what they can hide, but if they can't, for example, produce the black boxes after separate leaders say they have the boxes in their possession, that's going to be a real question.
All right. I want to take a call from Joe. He's on the line from Marfa, Texas. Joe, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I have a comment. Obviously, in Syria and in all these other countries, and sanctions don't work. But let's go to the big picture here. A country is powerful who has a populace who will use their overwhelming military force. We are not going to – people in the United States, listen, do you want to send people to Crimea? What happened to that? Do you want to send people to Iraq right now? That's a 1,500-year-old a war. Do you want to send people to military to the Palestinian situation? Do you want to send them to Syria? If it wasn't for the oil, we wouldn't be there. If a country has oil in the middle of Africa and we need it, we'd be taking it. So let's get reality here. This is just this idea that America can get involved, it's nonsense. This is a European problem. If America doesn't want to go to war with their boots, all right, we can't influence Europe. Europe itself does not want to get in the middle of that war.
Joe, I think we've got the idea. Thanks so much for your call. Angela, is that the voice of common sense from Joe, or is that sticking your head in the sand?
Well, I think the majority of Americans, I've looked at public opinion data on this, you know, they clearly don't want to get involved in a military conflict with Russia in Ukraine. But that's never been on the cards. And obviously there's that pressure on President Obama, too, which is to pull back from military involvement. Let me just say one other thing, and that is actually the U.S. doesn't need anybody's oil anymore. We're more or less energy self-sufficient. So that's really not – we're not involved in the Middle East anymore because of oil, but because of all of these other major geopolitical problems.
Stephen, I want to get you to look beyond tomorrow and next week and next month and even next year. Just think about, as you having served as an ambassador to Ukraine, what is Ukraine going to look like in 5 years? Will it have the borders that that exist today, or are we going to see something radically different, controlled entirely or in part by Russia?
Well, Ukraine, first of all, is in a very vulnerable and fragile situation, first and foremost because of bad decisions made by 20 years of Ukrainian leadership up until now, which have put the country in this weak position. They've inflicted a lot of damage on themselves. Leaders like Mr. Yanukovych, who were far more interested in personal gain and corruption than they were in getting the country strengthened. I think Ukraine has a chance, but it faces lots of difficult problems: economic reform, fighting corruption, trying to stabilize the situation in eastern Ukraine. And this is an issue where, again, if the Russians would back off, if the Russians would cut the flow of weapons and cut the flow of supplies to the separatists in eastern Ukraine, if the Russians would use their influence, and there are some groups in eastern Ukraine who may be local, but there are also some groups that are under control of Russian citizens. Moscow has significant influence there. If they could stop the fighting, create this prospect of some kind of a negotiation, and Kyiv could stitch the relationship back together with the eastern part of the country, it could then move on and tackle some other problems. So there's a chance. But the Russians have a big say in whether or not the government in Kyiv is going to have the opportunity to take advantage of that opportune chance.
Stephen Pfeiffer, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, currently director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative. Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. Thanks for both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in a moment, we'll talk to a reporter in Gaza on the recent deadly violence there. This is On Point. And now to the deadly weekend in the Middle East. 13 Israeli soldiers killed in the ground offensive. The Palestinian death toll over 500. Now Secretary of State John Kerry is on his way to Egypt to try to push a ceasefire. Joining me now from Gaza is Noah Browning, regional correspondent for Reuters. Noah, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Noah, catch us up to date on what's happened since the incredible outpouring of violence and casualties over the weekend.
Well, John, it's been another horrendous day of Israeli shelling on the eastern border areas of the Gaza Strip here. Listening into it from our office in the center of Gaza City, you could hear shells raining down almost every second, reverberating through this whole very tiny, very densely populated area, causing many, many injuries, and as you said, raising the Palestinian death toll to over 500.
Now, I was talking last week in Washington to the Israel's ambassador to the United States, and he said something that Benjamin Netanyahu also said, the prime minister, which is that this is a targeted operation to tunnels and rocket launching sites, but it might expand. Is the level of violence that we're seeing an indication that it has expanded, or is this what it looks like to go after the tunnels and the rocket launch sites?
Well, I think based on the sheer number of casualties we've seen in this 14 days of violence, according to UN figures, something between 70 and 80% of the dead are civilians. Israel has the argument that Hamas is firing rockets at it from civilian areas, which on the ground reporting, I would probably not dispute. It's a very densely populated area. But what one wonders, the sheer damage to neighborhoods and places that house hundreds of thousands of people in this campaign leads one to wonder just how targeted it can be. I believe there was a hot mic moment in which Secretary of State John Kerry said that if this is a pinpoint operation, it's a hell of a pinpoint operation. That's not something that has clearly made it into U.S. policy stances yet, but I think there's an impression among leaders that very many civilians are paying the price for what damage Israel is trying to inflict on Hamas here.
Could you explain what happened in the one neighborhood, I believe it's pronounced Shahaya, which seemed to be a locus of the violence over the weekend? Why there, and what exactly happened?
Well, up to now, not all the details are clear. It seemed that yesterday morning, in the very early hours, as part of Israel's ground incursion, it started sending troops, tanks into the area, and they appeared to face heavy resistance from armed Palestinian militants there. Now, as you had said, this was the same incident in which 13 Israeli soldiers were killed. It seems that in the fray of all this very heavy fighting, Israel started laying down a very, very serious barrage of artillery fire on this area, causing the residents of this neighborhood, and like I said, this neighborhood is gigantic. It's very densely populated, much like the rest of Gaza. It houses tens of thousands of people. They started pouring out down the streets westward, seeking safety. Now, I must also add that Hamas last night claimed to have abducted an Israeli soldier in these clashes. And this is a claim that Israel has not clearly confirmed or denied.
I thought they had disproved that claim. Is that not so? Is that still an open question?
It's not yet entirely clear. Its UN envoy in New York yesterday said that there was no truth to it. A military spokesman contacted by Reuters earlier today said he could still not confirm the reports.
Noah, is it possible for you to tell whether or not it appears the Israeli operation on its own terms is working so far, or does the fact that they've sustained 13 deaths among the IDF forces, is that an indication that it's not going well?
I'm not sure that the Israeli or even the Palestinian goals in this conflict are terribly clear. Now, if the Israelis defined their goals as eliminating Hamas, making it so that there were no armed Palestinian militants who ever wanted to do them harm, I think that would be a very, very tough objective for them to achieve.
And they say that's not their goal. They say it's more limited than that.
They say they're targeting these cross-border tunnels that militants use to attack Israeli civilians and soldiers. It seems that by doing a ground operation, they can make a lot of progress in that regard. But as we've seen, the sheer number of civilian casualties they've incurred on the Palestinian side, something like 150 in the last 2 days, is going to take a public relations toll on them. And I suspect will put some kind of diplomatic pressure on them to wrap this up sooner rather than later.
Well, I want to get to the diplomatic pressure in a second, but is it not also extraordinary for Israel to suffer the loss of as many soldiers as it, in fact, lost over the weekend? That must come as something of a shock to the Israeli populace.
I'm certain that it's a very painful blow. I mean, considering that military service is mandatory in Israel. There's a culture of nostalgia and solidarity about being in the army, and the fact that they lost so many young soldiers in a fight like this is probably going to hit the Israeli population and consciousness hard. But obviously, there's a great disproportionality in terms of losses in this conflict, maybe 15 total on the Israeli side and 500 on the Palestinian, that Palestinians are concerned that attention on these fallen soldiers in combat will detract from what they think is a what they've called a massacre and a genocide on their side.
Now, do you get the feeling that, you know, late last week, Israel was saying it had the support of the United States, it had the support of Europe. People were saying, of course, Israel has the right to defend against these rockets. Do you see that tide changing? And are we hearing increasing criticism of Israeli actions from people that they care about criticizing them?
I sense that there's not yet the kind of concrete progress, especially in the public realm, from Israel's closest allies to try to push through a diplomatic solution on them. Like I said yesterday in statements, John Kerry reiterated things that we've heard before about wanting to have Israel defend itself, but in unguarded moments, it seemed to acknowledge that it was taking a very, right, very punishing toll on Palestinians.
Noah Browning, regional correspondent for Reuters, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point Radio podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.